Welcome to the Juliana Forlano Show. I'm Juliana Forlano. As promised, this week we have Dr. Jill Stein, Green Party presidential candidate. We're going to be asking her all of our questions and all of the questions that you listeners emailed in over the course of last week. I've already spoken to her. It was a great interview, and I hope you enjoy it. But of course, we're going to start off the show, as we always do, with some much-needed jokes. Stay tuned.
Time for jokes.
Fool me once.
Headline and jokes.
Shame on you.
Jokes and headline.
Fool me, we can't get fooled again.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
All right, let's get started with some jokes. Donald Trump is still enjoying his 15 minutes of fame. He continues to top the polls, even though most demographic groups are against him, including Hispanics, blacks, and women. The main demographic in support of Trump is the coalition of f***ing nuts. They're crazy. Trump actually pledged to forego a third party run. Not to be outdone, Chris Christie pledged never to run at all. Sarah Palin had some harsh words for immigrants this week, demanding that they, quote, speak American. In response, all immigrants everywhere said, you first.
Things must change for this cover, our government.
Palin is eyeing a cabinet post in Trump's administration. Meanwhile, Trump is just plain eyeing Palin. Ew. Kermit the Frog made more headlines this week since he's now dating another pig. How could he get over Miss Piggy so fast? Maybe he's just trying to get, I don't know, two pigs in a blanket? Rumor has it that Miss Piggy has moved on from her relationship with Kermit. Apparently, if Piggy wanted to date a spineless puppet, she would have gone out with Scott Walker. Kentucky clerk and avowed family valuetarian Kim Davis got out of jail this week after having been arrested for refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay couples in her state. Now the only limit on marriage in Kentucky is the one between first cousins. Happy birthday to Robert De Niro, who recently turned 72 years old. Now when he asks, are you talking to me, it's because his hearing aid is turned off.
You talking to me? Well, then who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me?
Daycare workers are in trouble after being accused of staging a sort of fight club. Look, if you want to watch a bunch of five-year-olds fight, just watch the next Republican debate. Miley Cyrus announced she's pansexual. Meanwhile, Chris Christie announced that he is frying pansexual. Some cadets at West Point were injured during a pillow fight. Unfortunately, that comes with the territory when you train using live pillows. Melissa Rivers says Joan's ashes were scattered in Wyoming. I might be wrong, but I thought plastic had to be recycled. That one's for Joan. She would not want me to have held back. Cops are looking for a suspect in the murder of a Texas dentist. The suspect is described as 3 feet tall with sharp teeth, a long tail, and a strong desire for revenge. A police sergeant was denied service at Arby's. Apparently, the cook didn't want to be charged with assaulting an officer. After a month off, lawmakers are returning to work. They're eager to buckle down since there's only about a week until their next vacation. Ah, the jokes. I love the jokes, and I hope you do too. Okay, joining us in the studio today, Dr. Jill Stein, Green Party candidate for President of the United States of America in 2016. Jill Stein is a mother, housewife, physician, longtime teacher of internal medicine, and a pioneering environmental health advocate. She's the co-author of two widely praised reports. One is called In Harm's Way, Toxic Threats to Child Development, that was in 2000, and Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging, published in 2009. The first of these have been translated into four languages and is used worldwide. The reports promote green local economies, sustainable agriculture, clean power, and freedom from toxic threats. Her Healthy People, Healthy Planet teaching program reveals the links between human health, climate security, and green economic revitalization. This body of work has been presented at government, public health, and medical conferences and has been used to improve public policy, Jill began to advocate for the environment as a human health issue in 1998 when she realized that politicians were simply not acting to protect children from toxic threats emerging from current science. She offered her services to parents, teachers, community groups, and a Native American group seeking to protect their communities from toxic exposure. Jill has testified before numerous legislative panels, as well as local and state governmental bodies. She's played a key role in the effort to get the Massachusetts fish advisories updated to better protect women and children from mercury contamination, which can contribute to learning disabilities and ADD in children. She also helped lead the successful campaign to clean up the Filthy Five coal plants in Massachusetts, an effort that resulted in getting coal plant regulations signed into law that were the most protective around at that time. Her testimony on the effects of mercury and dioxin contamination from the burning of waste helped preserve the Massachusetts moratorium on new trash incinerator construction in the state. Jill has appeared as an environmental health expert on the Today Show, 2020, Fox News, and other programs. She was also a member of the National and Massachusetts Boards of Directors for the Physicians for Social Responsibility. Her efforts to protect public health have won her several awards, including Clean Water Action's Not in Anyone's Backyard Award, the Children's Health Hero Award, and the Toxic Action Center Citizen Award. Having witnessed the ability of big money to stop health protective policies on Beacon Hill, Jill became an advocate for campaign finance reform and worked to help pass the Clean Election Law. This law was approved by voters in a 2-to-1 margin, but was later repealed by the Massachusetts legislature on an unrecorded voice vote. Boo. In 2002, ADD activists in the Massachusetts Green Rainbow Party approached Dr. Stein and asked her to run for governor of Massachusetts. Dr. Stein accepted and began her first foray into electoral politics. She was widely credited with being the best informed and most credible candidate in the race. She has twice been elected to town meeting in Lexington, Massachusetts. She is the founder and past co-chair of a local recycling committee appointed by the Lexington Board of Selectmen. In 2003, Dr. Stein co-founded the Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities, a nonprofit organization that addresses a variety of issues that are important to the health and well-being of Massachusetts communities, including healthcare, local green economies, and grassroots democracy. Jill represented the Green Rainbow Party in two additional races, one for Senate Representative in 2004 and one for Secretary of State in 2006. In 2006, she won the votes of over 350,000 Massachusetts citizens, which represented the greatest vote total ever for a Green Rainbow candidate. In 2008, Jill helped formulate a Secure Green Future ballot initiative that called upon legislators to accelerate efforts to move the Massachusetts economy to renewable energy and make development of green jobs a priority. The measure won over 81% of the vote in the 11 districts in which it was on the ballot. Jill was born in Chicago and raised in suburban Highland Park, Illinois. She graduated magna cum laude from Harvard College in 1973 and from Harvard Medical School in 1979. Jill enjoys writing and performing music, long walks with her Great Dane Bandita. Dr. Stein lives in Lexington with her husband, Richard, who is also a physician. She has two sons, Ben and Noah, who have graduated from college in the past few years. I had the great pleasure of sitting down in my studio here talking to Jill Stein earlier today. And this is our conversation. I hope you enjoy it. So it is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Jill Stein. Thank you so much for joining us here in the studio today.
It's so good to be with you, Julianne.
It's really great to have you. So why don't we just jump right off and first start talking about your platform for 2016. What are the key components of your platform?
Well,
I know that's a big question, but I wanted to give you as big of a jumping off point as possible.
So let me just put it in context. We have an economic crisis and we have a climate crisis and a lot of other things related to that as well, including a foreign policy crisis and a democracy and a healthcare, et cetera. And, you know, you can't really solve these things in isolation. So we really do need a substantive systemic fix. So we call our plan a Power to the People plan, and it has several major components, but it's basically about that. It's about assuring that we meet the needs of people, which are critical and have only gotten bigger. And it is fair to say, you know, the economy is not in a recovery as much as they would like us to believe it. It's really a state of emergency. And the same.
And what makes you say that? I mean, other than looking outside, but just generally speaking.
Yes. Well, you know, you can look at the data. A study was just released this week, actually, by the Employment Law Foundation, some foundation with a name like that, that basically showed that wages are going down. Even in this so-called recovery, wages are going down. And they're going down most for the lowest paid workers. We're seeing unemployment rates come down, but what kind of jobs are people getting? They're getting low-wage, part-time, and temporary jobs. 75%, in fact, of the jobs being created are these part-time and temp jobs, which are awful. They're really not keeping people out of poverty, even. We have 40 million young people who are in debt, college debt, really without an option to repay it because the jobs that they can get are lousy. And young people who don't incur that debt, who don't go to college, have astounding rates of unemployment. 33% for Caucasian youth who have the best profile to African-American youth who have unemployment rates above 50% if they don't have something beyond a high school degree.
So, do you think that the current enormous fluctuations in the market have, I mean, I'm not an expert here, but I'm watching things go up and down by 400 points a day, and it certainly seems like that has to be connected to this crisis.
Definitely, as both a generator of the crisis as well as a symptom of the crisis, that we have really allowed the tippy top, you know, beyond the 1% to hoard the resources. You know, the money's gone to the top, and then we've poured in $17 trillion worth of quantitative easing for Wall Street, essentially, which has provided them with limitless cash with which to gamble. So the fact, you know.
They were supposed to create jobs, I think, with that money?
Yes, exactly. Right, or somehow stabilize the economy. But it's just intensified the financialization of our economy. A financialized economy is not a working economy. It's a gambling economy. It's a predatory and parasitic economy. It pushes papers and it charges people for the honor of, you know, of having their money pushed around. So we've got a really sick economy, and we need to change that economy. So, and let me just underscore that we also have a climate crisis, which is truly in crisis. We can feel that, you know, in the heat of the day here, but you can also look at the numbers that 2014 was set records. We're now beating all those records. We're looking at fire all up and down the West Coast, even into Alaska, these absolutely record-setting fires, drought. California has 1 year of surface water left. We hear about places in California where the ground is actually sinking by 2 inches a month. Okay, a month, your house isn't going to stay up very long at that rate. And it's sinking so much because the groundwater is being tapped into because we don't have the surface water. So we have an emergency.
And also fracking. They're taking water for fracking.
They sure are. They're taking water for all kinds of terrible things, including industrial agriculture. Mm-hmm. So the whole, you know, ship is going down right now. And add to that, you know, extinctions, we're losing 150 species a day. And we've entered headlong into the sixth great extinction, where the scientists are saying we're looking at basically half the species gone by the end of the century, which is essentially curtains for humankind because
If the bees go, we're in trouble. Just the one species is enough to put us over the edge as a human species.
Exactly. And I think the point here is, you know, it's not just to wave these red flags, but to make the point that the track we're on is absolutely, it's homicidal, it is, you know, it's biocidal, it's planetcidal, it's absolutely crazy, it's being inflicted on us. This is not the will of the public. This is the will of, you know, of the predatory state and the fossil fuel companies, et cetera, who basically want to stay the course. The public is very concerned about climate change. The public actually supports, in some polls, 70%, a Green New Deal that would create a jobs program to remedy the problem. And that's where I'm going with this. Our our platform is basically to fix this crisis and to fix it now. It's not a matter of choosing the climate or the economy. You can only fix them together. You cannot fix them separately. So this divide and conquer strategy is absolutely false, and it's really embraced by the power holders who are quaking in their boots that we should get together across these critical issues of climate justice and economic justice. Because the minute we get together, we have a majority. We have a blueprint. We have plans. We have community values. We know how to do this. And that's essentially what our platform is. It's to declare the state of emergency that we're in and to go about the business of fixing it. And specifically, we're calling for a Green New Deal with 20 million community-based living wage jobs that transition us on an emergency basis to 100% clean renewable energy by the year 2030. That's an emergency. But you know what? We did that after Pearl Harbor was bombed. We declared emergency. And you know how long it took to move the economy, which had zero militarization? Zero. We went from 0 to 25% of GDP in the course of 6 months. So if we could gear up in 6 months to develop a wartime economy, certainly, over the course of 10 years, we can convert to a green economy. And in doing so, this is the wonderful thing, and the last thing that I have to say about this.
I hope it's not.
Okay, well, I could go on. I could take the whole hour on this. But the amazing thing and the well-kept secret here is that this actually pays for itself. And there have been great studies done actually using New York State.
That was you answering my question. Yes, go ahead.
New York State, there's been a terrific study done by Mark Jacobson out of Stanford. They modeled New York and what it would cost to move to 100% by 2030. That is clean, renewable, wind, water, and sun. And what they found was that the savings in not only energy, because you save a lot of money in energy once you're using renewables, but and there are many other savings here too, but just looking at healthcare, you save so much money from turning off the poison by virtue of air pollution and water pollution, the cancer-causing chemicals. It's cancer, it's emphysema, it's heart disease, it's stroke, it's diabetes. We take these things as if they're just part of,
living. They just happen, sure.
They're not. These are human-made diseases. And Cuba's a really good example because Cuba's pipeline, their oil pipeline, went down in 1990. Forget Cuba's healthcare system, which is a wonderful system, but just forget about their healthcare system for the moment, because they had the same healthcare system when this happened. They lost their oil supply when the Soviet Union collapsed, and they had to convert overnight to clean energy. They just didn't have anything to burn, and they had to also convert to an organic and sustainable food system, and they had to use public transportation as well as walking and biking. Those are all things that we, don't we deserve that too? A public transit system that's affordable and that doesn't poison us, and a food system that is also healthy and doesn't poison us. So it turned out when Cuba did this, and mind you, they spent $0 on this. That's how much it cost. $0. Their death rates from diabetes went down 50%. Their death rates from heart attacks and strokes went down 25 to 35%. Their all-cause mortality went down. Obesity rates went down 50%. Great things happened, and they spent $0. We spend $3 trillion a year, and we can't even come close
to that.
On healthcare alone, we can't even come close. So the point here is that by moving to clean, renewable energy and a green economy, just the energy part saves so much money, it pays for the energy transition. But we're calling, in addition, if you really want to meet these needs, you also need a sustainable and healthy local organic food system. And I think the public transit was actually included in their data. But they didn't model the impacts of active transit. Because once you integrate activity into people's lives, guess what?
They're healthier.
And you don't have to spend $1,000 buying some health club subscription.
That always burns me.
And then you have to go drive to your health club, Instead, you actually have clean air and safe sidewalks and wonderful communities
that's easy to picture in a space like New York City, in spaces where it's a car culture. I grew up in the suburbs. To walk anywhere takes a lot of time.
And that's why we need a public transportation system.
I see.
Because I just got here to Brooklyn in not very long, faster than I could have driven it, using the public transit. And that makes the point, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so public transportation across the board, not just in our big cities, but even in smaller areas.
That's right. So you have inner city transit and, you know, and you have safe sidewalks and bike paths in order to get to your transit hubs.
The startup capital to switch from what we have now, which is a Koch brother dirty oil economy, to a green energy economy, comes from where?
All kinds of places. So, for example, we're paying a huge price for this bloated, reckless, trigger-happy foreign policy that we have. And the studies show very clearly that when the drones go in, Al-Qaeda and ISIS follow, that murdering civilians, innocent civilians, is a very bad foreign policy. And on balance, it has been massively counterproductive, doesn't put it mildly. And then you add full-scale invasions like Iraq, where we killed a million civilians, basically, you know, and have created the mess that we now call ISIS. So this is a lousy foreign policy. A militarized foreign policy is extremely dangerous, most of all to us, and is creating all the blowback that we're seeing now. And it's absolutely beyond comprehension that they want to do more of the same in order to fix, you know, the results, you know, of this system. They want to do more of this. It's absolutely crazy.
My understanding of that is because it's military contractors who are making tons of money, and the people who make war machines are making tons of money.
Exactly.
How are we going to wrest that power out of the hands of these war makers?
Well, this is exactly why you have to do this as a broad program, because any one issue will never get to critical mass, whether it's the health care we need or the jobs that we need or stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership or ending student debt. You know, all of these are critical things that will benefit all of us. That's why we need a broad coalition for people, planet, and peace. And you put us all together, boy, do we have the numbers. In fact, take student debt alone. There are 40 million plus current and former students who are swamped with debt in a economy.
How many years do you think this forgiveness of debt could go back? I'm just wondering. Not for personal reasons. I'm just... I mean, a lot of people are swamped with debt, not just young people.
Exactly. That's right, which is why I said current and former students, because it does go substantially back. And I think it's especially egregious, put it this way, in the current economy where students were lured into education with the promise of jobs. And this has certainly been the case for the past decade. But, you know, in my view, education is not something we should put our younger generation through the ringer for. It ought to be a birthright. That's what an older generation...
Because it makes a great society.
It makes a great society. And this is our highest gift to our... you know, our greatest resource and treasure, which is our children, right? And in the 20th century, we provided free education through high school because that was essential for economic security. And in today's world, we certainly need a college degree in order to be secure. And those numbers that I rattled off earlier are certainly evidence of that. So simply, you know, on the basis of doing what's right, we should be providing free public higher education, which will bring down also the cost of the private education. But we at least need
because
to provide
of competition.
Yes,
if you can go for free
exactly.
over here and it's still good, then are you going to pay $80,000 a year to go over there?
Plus, we know from World War II and the GI Bill that every dollar invested in higher education is repaid 700%. Okay, it's a 700% return on your investment. So this basically, you know, this is just a matter of priming the pump for that, which is, you know, could be, well, in the case of, put it this way, in the case of free public higher education, it's estimated to be anywhere from $35 to $60 billion dollars a year. But that is small potatoes compared to what we're spending on the military security. Yes, exactly. Or a battleship,
well,
you know.
We'd have to do the actual math because I'm sure it would be even more pathetic than what I just pulled off the top of my head.
Just looking at the numbers, we're spending $1 trillion. We're spending $1 trillion on the military security atomic weapons complex.
Now, we happen to be sitting in a very, what seems like a very dangerous time, perhaps created by our own former war hawks and current war hawks. They don't ever No one ever finds peace, it seems like. Cheney never turned, you know, they're going to Cheney now for advice. Cheney, the architect of a catastrophe, as Katrina VandenHeuvel has said in The Nation.
As if Obama wasn't, you know. And I think that's important to remember, that while it's very easy to pin this on the Republicans because they're so transparent about it, you know, that's nice. At least they're transparent. But, you know, Obama fought tooth and nail to extend the war in Iraq. And the only reason the troops were brought home when they were was because George Bush had signed on in advance to a date of essentially withdrawal where U.S. soldiers no longer had immunity.
And so, now the Republicans are saying, well, Obama brought the troops home.
Yeah, right.
So you can't really win for losing.
It really was Bush who brought the troops home.
Right.
If they want to blame someone.
Exactly.
That's right.
So, but Obama has been doing using foreign policy with the Iran deal in a way that I haven't seen in quite some time. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, you know, diplomacy as opposed to bombing.
Well, I'd say now that Obama's on his way out, he's doing a number of good things now that he's completely powerless.
Right.
Not completely, but, you know, in terms of his economic agenda, now suddenly he's, you know, he's the advocate again for everyday people, as opposed to when we really needed him back in 2008, when he gave away $17 trillion to Wall Street and held them absolutely, you know, they were held harmless for what they did and, you know, and the mortgage fraud and all that.
I don't understand how he gave the money with no restrictions on what they were supposed to do with it. That is a little
there
bit of a shocker.
Well,
oh, we trust you, you people who did this, destroyed our economy in the first place. We trust you to not do that again. That seems a little unusual.
Unfortunately, that was the rule and not the exception, that there were incredible giveaways, and that continues. Look at the Affordable Care Act, for that matter, you know, which is a $400 billion annual boondoggle for insurance companies and creates
Let's talk about
market.
That. You are a physician, and your husband is a physician. Let's talk about Obamacare. There's, I think it's 16.4 million people who have health insurance coverage since the Affordable Care Act became law about 5 years ago, and that was back in May, so who knows if there's more by now. That is what the Obama administration touts as a success. What are we missing here?
Just don't get sick. It's great to have that piece of paper, but if you get sick, particularly if you become significantly ill and chronically ill, there are, you know, enough holes to drive a hearse through, unfortunately, in the Affordable Care Act. And I live in Massachusetts, where we used to call it Romney Care before it was Obamacare. And we had a track record of about 5 years' experience before Obamacare. And I will say they both bills were passed in the same way. They were written behind closed doors by the insurance and pharmaceutical industries. In my home state of Massachusetts, this 145-page bill, which was tiny compared to Obamacare, it didn't even... you know, it wasn't even available to legislators to read until the night before. So this was basically a bill that was passed nearly unanimously because the powers that be said it should be. And it gave away
the store. Well, that's something you can't trust when they do it like that. They don't let you read the bill. You know there's something bad in there.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
Yeah.
And that got borne out. And what we saw happening in Massachusetts was that people got their piece of paper, but for those who were chronically sick, it became even harder, according to surveys, it became even harder for sick people to get the care they needed. And meanwhile, the safety net was destroyed. And, you know,
the safety net.
Yeah, the healthcare safety net, that is public hospitals, the free care pool, things like that. Some of the community health center funding, et cetera. There were a number of things that just made it harder to have something to fall back on. So, it, you know, medical bankruptcies, which are a really good indicator of whether this is working or not, have been absolutely unchanged, not inside Massachusetts and not generally nationally. So I'd say it's a good thing that more people have insurance, but it's not at all what it's made out to be. And there are about 70 million now who are said to be either uninsured or underinsured.
So you would say for the Green Platform, Medicare for all.
We need Medicare for all more than
single
ever.
Payer.
Yes, and the cost has not been controlled either under the Affordable Care Act.
Funded by the taxpayer, and that's going to get all of Fox News all crazy, right? Who funds Medicare? Who funds our Medicare for all?
Absolutely. I mean, taxpayers are funding it right now anyhow, but it's just a much more expensive system, and it doesn't cover everybody. We would actually...
I guess we wouldn't have to pay insurance fees So
well, exactly. And
right.
You know, and you would get your wages would be your wages, and you wouldn't be bargaining for, you know, for a health care benefit, which is where so many wages have gone.
You would think people on the right would like that.
Well, you know, the right, I think it's really important not to swallow their inflated egos, because polls show, in fact, that it's 20% of Americans that identify with the Republican Party. 20%, okay? And it's 29% that identify as Democrats. So Republicans...
And everybody else is just pissed.
Exactly. And ready... Well, it's 60%, actually. 58 to 60% are saying we need a new independent third party. So this is
or
why
a
they...
few would be nice.
Exactly. I mean, in my opinion, definitely. Yeah. Yes. And that is the long-term solution. But, you know, it's one step at a time for, mm-hmm. you know, people out there who have not been exposed to those things. But even a third independent party would be a huge step in the right direction. But I wanted to mention before it slips by that we have two legal cases. One is already filed in federal court, and the second one is coming up in about 2 weeks, that are suing the Commission on Presidential Debates, speaking of multiple parties, because they are breaking the law, as they have been ever since the commission was taken over by the Democratic and Republican parties in the 80s, I believe. And
by not allowing third-party candidates
to
debate.
By only allowing Democrats and Republicans to debate, basically. Mm-hmm. They have a bipartisan debate, but the law requires them to hold nonpartisan debates. So we're making exactly that point. That
Jill,
50%,
when did you think that, where did you get the idea we're still under the rule of law here in the United States? It seems like,
well, put it this way. We got a lot of unhappy campers out there.
Yeah.
And the rebellion is in full swing. And that rebellion tends to go along issue lines. And it's a very strong and inspired rebellion, whether you're looking at Black Lives Matter or the movement to end student debt or the Dreamers and immigrant rights, you know, women's rights, et cetera. We've got well-organized movements. But what we don't have now is kind of a unifying agenda and a unifying coordination and organization. That's what political parties are supposed to be before they got sold out to basically big money. So they're essentially useless for public purpose right now. And that's where the Green Party is working very hard to create a public interest party. What is a party? A party should be a coalition to get things done, but it's a coalition across issues, across time, and across geography. It's a coalition that holds together, as opposed to, you know, supporting a candidate for one race. Mm. You can never really overcome the power of money in one race. You know, you really have to build an infrastructure and an organization.
Are you talking about Bernie Sanders?
Well, it could be Bernie. It could have been many of Bernie's predecessors. This is the whole, you know, and this has been a very long historical struggle. What is the point of independent third parties? The point of independent third parties is that without them, you get exactly what we've been getting right now. This is not a historic aberration. This is exactly what you get. And when the New Deal was passed in the 1930s, a big coalition came together that absorbed the independent parties, like the socialists and the progressives. Everything started to unravel after that. Mm. You need independent third parties if you're going to push things forward. If all you have are political structures that are bought and paid for by the major financial interests, you will see exactly what's been happening since the 30s and the 40s, which is that them that's got keeps getting, and then that them that don't keeps losing.
Here's a question. Back to those two lawsuits. Will they be adjudicated in time for a third-party candidate to potentially take the stage in this potential election in 2016?
They are very well conceived and well run, and they have very good lawyers on them, including Bruce Fine, who was actually an assistant attorney general under Reagan, but he's a big civil liberties proponent. So there are very respected legal people who are involved, and they have basically framed them in such a way as to expedite the discussion. And I would let me encourage people to go to our website, jill2016.com. In the next couple of days, say a week to play it safe, we'll have a petition up. We're sending a petition to the Commission on Presidential Debates right now because they have said that they will issue new rules in October. And we'll see what that's going to be. But we want them to hear from the public in advance that we demand that there be more voices and more choices. If 50% of Americans are not Democrats and not Republicans, we need to reflect the diversity of political opinion so that we can actually move our democracy forward.
The Tea Party would probably, do you think they would break off from the Republican Party? They seem to hate any kind of moderate. They're doing a great job taking over the whole Republican Party and sinking it. So
they sure are. But what we're really calling for here are parties that don't represent big money. And the problem with the Tea Party is that it got hijacked by very big money. So it's just a new version of the same old corporate politics.
Mm. Bernie Sanders said he was running as a Democrat, much to the chagrin of many people on the left who wanted and encouraged him to run as an independent because he could reach millions of likely voters with his vision of an alternative politics of America. That is what he sees as a break from politics as usual. And he said, he continues to say that he is in it to win. People laughed when he joined the campaign. They made fun of his hair and they dismissed him. And now he beat Hillary by 9 points in New Hampshire and he's as much as there's a media blackout, he is popular with progressive media outlets like my show. I don't make any, you know, but you're here, too. So, you know, we're not shutting the door there. What do you think about Bernie's run as a Democrat?
I wish Bernie all the luck and strength and good wishes in the world.
Because it seems like he is trying to get that message out.
Totally, yes.
Using the system as it is now.
Right. In my view, Bernie's campaign may be doing a lot of things right, and I don't completely agree with everything, but we have so much in common, it totally overshadows the differences. And Bernie, you know, is doing a great job of raising those issues. The real question, though, is this different from Jesse Jackson's campaign, which was incredibly powerful and had a huge base of support? You may remember even Howard Dean was really flying very high. Mm-hmm. What did the Democrats do? They launched a PR campaign actually against Howard Dean, the Dean Scream, mm-hmm. and brought him down. They did the same thing against Jesse Jackson, making him out to be a, quote, anti-Semite, unquote, because of some statements about his Israel policy. And, you know, really mischaracterized him and brought him down in the polls. And then they have, you know, the built-in kill switch, which is the money primaries, the Super Tuesdays in March, and then the superdelegates, which are very hard to win, too. So it's very hard to get past the structure of the Democratic Party. After George McGovern won the nomination and then was massively defeated, in part because the Democratic Party abandoned him after he was able to win the nomination. The powers in the party didn't want him there. And, you know, he lost, profoundly. Ever since then, you know, the Democratic Party revised its structure in order to make it very difficult for that to happen. And my reading of history, you know, is that it's very unlikely someone's going to overcome this within the Democratic Party. Now, you could say, well, what makes you think the Green Party is going to do better? Well, the point is the Green Party is not limited to one campaign. And the whole point of the Green Party is to inspire this uprising at many levels of government. Mm. As Eugene Debs did in his presidential runs, he inspired socialists and progressives to, to challenge power at the local level, the municipal, the state, and congressional, and even governors. And they won all up and down the board, and they actually advanced many of the policies that then later became part of the New Deal. So there's a whole strategy here. I think at the end of the day, the Bernie strategy and our campaign are extremely complementary. Mm-hmm. If Bernie wins the nomination, more power to him.
Do you think the Green? Well, I guess you'd be running against him if he wins the nomination.
Yes, but you know what? If he doesn't win the nomination, which odds would suggest are the likely thing, then we're going to be voiceless. Is that what we want? You know, I think Bernie supporters don't want that either. So, you know, I think people who are supporting Bernie probably want to hedge their bets and make sure that they have a plan B. and meaning that we're ready to go.
Meaning allowing the Green Party to get into those debates.
Not just allowing, but I mean, supporting and ensuring that we get on the ballot. I think, you know, I think it makes sense for people who are contributing and working for Bernie's campaign to also be working for our campaign as the backup plan, because there's an urgent need here. If Bernie gets defeated, which odds would suggest and history would suggest that the Democratic Party is going to make it really hard for him to prevail here, if that happens, do we want to leave this to Hillary and whoever the Republicans come up with?
Now, here's the question, though, and this is the question. Boy, people got so mad. I said, I'm having Jill Stein on there. Well, you better ask her this question. And this was the one that gets everyone's hair on the back of their neck if they have any standing up. So let's say it's Hillary, and let's say it's Jill Stein, and let's say it's Jeb Bush or one of those other clowns. Not the clowniest one, but, you know, one of those guys. If you split the Democratic Party vote, then the vote will go to the Republican, who is going to be so much further against, you know, even issues of identity politics, where Hillary Clinton is not so bad. She's just kind of horrible on, you know,
everything else.
All the other stuff.
And I think the point here is that when you find differences between the Democratic and Republican Party, unfortunately, those differences are not enough to save your job, to save the planet, to save your life, to stop the wars, that the fundamentals keep going just as bad, if not worse. And really important to look at the Obama track record and compare it to George Bush, because Obama got away with murder. The murder of, you know, a whole lot of Iraqis, the drone murders, the you know, he's pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Who's pushing the privatization of our schools? You know, the attack on immigrants, on our civil liberties, on, you know, on the press. You know, who pushed the affordable health care plan?
He's jailed a lot of whistleblowers.
What?
He's jailed an enormous amount of whistleblowers.
More than everybody before him. Yeah. Is this how we make progress? I don't think so. You know, it's very clear that we are on a trajectory here that is not survivable. Under Democrats, just as bad. I mean, how much did Bush bail out Wall Street? It was $700 billion. How much did Obama bail out Wall Street? $17 trillion. So Obama gets away with a lot because he's got good rhetoric, and that's true for Democrats. But Hillary, you know, it's hard to distinguish Hillary except for some, you know, some identity politics for the most part. That is not going to save your life. And you can talk about, oh, these great, you know, Supreme Court nominations that are going to make all the difference in the world. Well, how about whether we have a planet to live on, you know? And our campaign is the only one that's actually stepping up to the plate for what needs to be done on climate change.
But I'm still left with, I agree with everything you're saying, but I'm still left with the horrible thought that a vote for a Green Party presidential candidate, if it comes down to Green Party, Hillary Clinton, and Jeb, is really a vote for Jeb.
Well, let me put it this way. I'd like to give that a name. That's called the politics of fear.
Well, we're terrified.
Right. Okay. Now look at where we've gotten practicing the politics of fear. The politics of fear delivered everything we were afraid of. Why were we supposed to vote for Obama and not vote for my campaign or not vote for Cynthia McKinney? Why were you supposed to do that? Because you didn't want the war to expand. You didn't want Wall Street bailouts. You didn't want an attack on immigrants. You didn't want, you know, you didn't want our schools to be privatized. All those things you didn't want, we have gotten beyond imagination because we have lost the power of resistance. Look what happened under Richard Nixon, okay? Under Richard Nixon, one of the most devious, regressive presidents ever. We won the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, women's right to choose from a Supreme Court that did not favor it. We won, you know, we ended the war in Vietnam. We did that because we were driving forward. Going to the voting booth and surrendering our vision and our values is not how we drive society forward. We need to have a very, you know, principled and defiant assertion of our democracy. Making excuses for, you know, a politician who's only slightly less devastating than another is not what you deserve. To me, this is like being in an abusive relationship, you know, and defending your partner because, oh, they're better than some other this jerk other guy, you could right. be hanging
you
out with.
You could have been with a horrible one or right. a pretty bad one.
Yeah, the question exactly. here, we deserve a democracy. We deserve an economy that's working for us. We deserve to, you know, to end these wars and bring our resources home. We deserve a climate that we can live on. We deserve students who are not you know, absolutely swamped with debt. So the world ain't working. Mm-hmm. And under a Democratic president with two Democratic houses of Congress, what did they do? They gave away the store to Wall Street. Mm. Well, worse than taking a nap, they went on the attack. They went on the attack against everyday people, against working people, against immigrants, you know, against the cause of peace, against the climate. And they're still attacking on the climate. Look what Obama's policy is about. This all of the above is a glorified drill baby drill. Mm. It's putting it into, you know, putting a smile on lethal policies is not going to save us.
And your green policy is basically to do a jobs program that's intensive, such as what we did, the mobilization after World War II, in order to transition us from fossil fuels to green energy.
By 2030, we have a date to be for it to be done.
God, I wish you would win.
Well, you know what?
I mean, this is the question. You know, the question is, it seems like just one electoral victory is not, given our current system, even if Jill Stein wins the presidency, you're still going to have to work with the horrendous Congress and the party of no and the other, the party of lay
in
down.
In order to ever win the presidency, you have to begin making progress. You know, if you look at Syriza, and granted there are real problems with Syriza, Syriza's evolving, but Syriza went from invisible to 5% to, what was it, 36% or something like that in the course of about 5 years. So, you know, you got to start from somewhere and then you have to build. And surrendering your vision and your values doesn't move you forward. And I've been around the block enough on this myself that I have seen us get beaten back time after time. I've seen us get sort of excited by the hope and the possibility inside of a party which is basically sold out. And it just, you know, even go beyond what's happened here in the last 20 or 30 years. If you look back since, you know, since the 1800s, even Karl Marx was talking about how you could not trust, in this case it was the Democrats in Germany, that were a bourgeois party of big business, that you would always be done in, that you should never trust your fate to a party that has been sold out. And in the words of Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, it never will. That demand has to exist in the political discourse.
There are several movements afoot now. The movement for Black Lives, the movement
exactly.
for even a $15 minimum wage, which you're talking, I've heard you say livable wage, not minimum wage, which I'd be interested to hear your take on after I ask you this movement question. And Bernie Sanders always talks about building a movement. Well, Barack Obama seemed to have, this was my first piece that I wrote after Barack Obama got in. I got a lot of calls. Hillary was always, you know, Michelle was emailing my inbox. All these people were emailing, move on, we were all ready to go. And he asked us to push him. And then he got into office and there was, you know, radio silence from, he was like, we're good now. I got this, kind of, when he came in. Whereas I'd hate to think that Bernie Sanders is doing the same thing, and looking back at his track record, at least he has a track record, whereas Barack Obama really didn't have much of a track record other than being just right. general centrist.
But it does speak volumes about the Democratic Party strategy that they would allow an Obama to get the nomination. Obama, who basically caved to big finance, you know, so he had loads of money to fight the fight with. So, you know, he was able to fight that fight as a very sold out candidate for a long time. Mm. Bernie is not doing that. Bernie has integrity, but he's banking on a party that has no integrity and that has never shown a bit of integrity. I myself, personally, I find it actually rather astonishing that people can put their hearts back into the Democratic Party now after having been so beat up in the last election.
I feel like the people who support Bernie are the people who are on the left of the Democratic Party and
yes.
even further to the left. Mm-hmm. And they're supporting Bernie and the fact that he is using what is at this moment, meaning if you're going to get on the debate stage. I mean, basically, no one talks about him anyway unless you're a progressive. or in the progressive sphere, it's not like you see a ton of Bernie on the morning shows. He has broken through, but it's always about, hey, everyone thinks you're just like Trump, and they don't even really give him any opportunity. He has done a great job just talking about the issues and saying, I'm not going to attack Hillary. I'm just going to talk about the issues. I'm not going to attack Trump. I'm just going to talk about the issues. It's what everyone always wants. It doesn't sell a lot of seats and commercials on TV. The question I'm kind of trying to point at here is, given all of these movements that are happening, I'll finish my point, which is that I think people are voting for Bernie despite his
attachment
to the Democratic Party.
I would agree. And I actually find that still rather remarkable, that people can manage to blot out the record of betrayal and, just horrible things the Democratic Party does.
I always saw him as using the party to have a greater platform than he would have gotten if he had run as an independent, which he is. Or he was.
And I think that's a legitimate political strategy. But in my view, you can't build independent politics unless you're actually building it. You can't, and that's what, I think true independent political people, socialists that Bernie claims to be one of, that's been really implicit in the party from way back, that you cannot build socialism inside the Democratic Party.
How are the state and lower level governmental chairs. Are there a number of Green Party candidates running across the board?
There are quite a few, yes. Margaret Flowers is running for Congress in Maryland. One name you would recognize.
Right, sure.
Yeah, and a number
of people. Is Howie running in upstate New York?
Howie actually is running for local office in Syracuse.
Yeah, that's where I'm from. I've had him on a show a couple times. Yeah.
Oh, you should have him on.
I would be happy to. He's fun to talk to.
He's great.
Yeah. It's very refreshing to just have people not mince their words about climate change and climate denial and all of that stuff. So I'd like to get to the questions that the audience asked. We may have covered some of this ground, but if we've already covered it, feel free to add and do what you think is right. Okay. So last week on the show, we had callers asking us to address the Israel-Palestine issue. I believe the caller's name was Rose, and then we got a series of calls that we couldn't take because it was right at the end of the show saying, yeah. And I said, well, she's going to be here next week, and I'll just ask her. So in a piece dated September 20th of 2012, in the journal Information Clearinghouse, you wrote that the United States policy regarding Israel and Palestine must be revised to make international law, peace, and human rights for all people, no matter their religion, nationality, and central priorities. How are we going to do this?
Well, put it this way. We need to stop funding governments that are committing war crimes. And there's no question that the Netanyahu government has exercised absolutely lethal and disproportionate force, that their occupation of Palestinian territories is a violation of international law, and yet we are funding them to the tune of more than $8 million per day for their military. So under a Green administration, under my administration, we would comply with international law in our foreign policy, and we would not be in the business of supporting governments that are in defiance, particularly in such massive and blatant defiance of international law and standards of human rights.
And it may or may not have an effect on their actions, but I think they have a pretty significant military budget outside of the United States' contributions. Am I correct about that?
They do, but the U.S. contribution of over $8 million a day is ginormous. So this would...
I think we need that money here. We are talking to presidential candidate Jill Stein of the Green Party here in the United States. We've come to the end of the hour that's going to be broadcast on our regular show. But I'd like if you could stay here to answer some of the rest of these questions. And I feel like we've basically just scratched the surface here. And I hope you'll come back and join us again.
I'd love to. Thanks.
That's the end of our program today. That's all we have time for. We've been speaking with Green Party candidate for president in 2016, Jill Stein. Happy to have her on the show. She surprised me with some of the answers that she had. I'm looking forward to hearing your feedback on this, you can get us at JulianaForlanoShow@gmail.com or go on our Facebook page and leave us a comment. Listen, if you want to hear the rest of this interview, because it is a little longer and she does kick some arse at the end of it, go to JulianaForlano.com and download the link. You can listen to the whole thing there or go on iTunes. Hey, listen, thanks for listening to our show. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and all that good stuff. Hey, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Good night.